Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Welcome to the Audible presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined as always by Bruce Feldman after another eventful Saturday in college football. Even with 18 games canceled, there were still plenty of other games to talk about. But I do want to start, Bruce, with, so oftentimes being on the West Coast, you wake up and you've missed some sort of news story that broke on East Coast time. And that was definitely the case Saturday morning when I woke up to a push notification on my phone that said the Clemson-Florida State game was canceled. And I'm like, oh, geez, yet another COVID situation. But I did not. But then once I started like reading our coverage and others, it was a very unique situation. You were up early working on it. What happened?
Yeah, so I go in on Saturday mornings at very early. So I go into the studio at around 4:30 a.m. our time. And not long after I got in, there was a note from both, I think it was first I saw something from Florida State and then the ACC about this. And I was like, wait a minute, this is the first day of postponement we've had this season. That made it a little more curious, I thought. And so I started making some calls on it. My initial hit into the show, into our pregame show, which comes on at 7 a.m. our time, 10 a.m. Eastern, we were like, we're going to have to change that and let's chase this story. So I made some calls to people both at the ACC, Clemson, and also at Florida State. And it's an interesting thing here because game day morning in every before every game, you will have the medical expert from or medical representative from each school plus the AD on a call with, in this case, the ACC. And they go over where they're at. And from what my sources were telling me, FSU had been disturbed by the fact that a Clemson offensive lineman had tested positive, and they had gotten that positive test after he had already traveled with the team for the Florida State game, and that this player had been practicing and been in meetings, and even though he had not tested positive before that, according to the people I talked to on the Florida State side, their understanding was that player was symptomatic, and so they worried that there was the risk of other players at Clemson also being infected with COVID, and as they deemed it, this is a high-risk position, being its alignment in the trenches. And as people I talked to at Florida State put it, they have been very, very cautious and very careful and followed protocols, and they have not had any positive COVID tests on their team for about 2 months, dating back to Mike Norvell's positive COVID test in mid-September. So that's really where it grew out of, is basically, Florida State was not comfortable with what they were dealing with on the Clemson side. And Clemson had felt like, hey, somebody at Clemson had mentioned to me that when they travel, their players double mask and they socially distance. And they were willing they still wanted to play the game. Florida State just didn't feel comfortable with that. And Florida State looked at it and said, well, look, we both have an open date on December 12th. We should play it then. And that's kind of where we're at. And this thing got pretty spicy in the middle of it.
We've talked since the very beginning, frankly, of the pandemic in terms of college football, how, I mean, you just knew a mess was coming because it's so, there's just no leadership and it's not centralized. I mean, you see when the NFL has had some issues where games had to be moved around,
the NFL just stepped in and did it. It's not like in college where these schools basically decide for themselves whether they're comfortable playing or when it should be moved to. And the inconsistency was evident just on Saturday when you had this situation where Florida State didn't feel comfortable. I'm never going to blame Florida State or anybody for not feeling comfortable and taking taking caution. I'm not going to say they're trying to duck Clemson or anything like that. That being said, a couple hours later, there was this weird situation in the Temple game, Temple East Carolina game, where a player tested positive right as they delayed the start of the game because there was a player who was having symptoms in the locker room. So they went and tested him. Sure enough, he's positive. They isolate him. They isolate several close contacts of his. And then they went ahead and played the game, which I'm not sure if that was a good idea either, but I don't know all the specifics. So it's just there's no need for this to be so having people pointing fingers and this school screwed us over and whatnot. Like, there should be one central decision maker who decides you should be able to play the game, you should not be able to play the game. We've had teams, you know, the SEC has that, all the conferences or most of the conferences have that roster minimum. And some teams, as soon as it hits that number, that 53 number, they're not going to play. But it's not a requirement. You can still play if you want to. So Mississippi State went ahead and went to Georgia with, I believe it was reported, 49 players available, and actually gave them a good game despite that. So I really hope that with Thanksgiving coming and all the students on all these campuses going home, that the outbreaks among the teams will start to subside, because this is getting, I mean, we're 18 cancellations and we've got in a week, and we got 4 more weeks left, and obviously running out of room to make up games, it could get really messy at the current trajectory.
Yeah, now, technically it's actually, you know, they're not all cancellations, a bunch of them are postponements, but yes, the point is taken.
Yeah, postponements, but we're running out of room to, I mean, there's some games already that just aren't going to be made up. I think the SEC is the one to watch. They're going to, I have a feeling this coming week, going to shuffle a whole bunch of stuff around to make LSU-Alabama happen. But they're one more outbreak away from somebody not being able to play their full slate either. So the game starts Saturday. Ohio State-Indiana was the first one. And it actually, I'll be honest, did not expect Indiana to stay in it till the end, but they absolutely did. Obviously, Justin Fields, 3 interceptions, very uncharacteristic. Indiana basically just came after him and blitzed him all game. He didn't play his best game, but they did get some great performances from their running backs. Michael Penix threw for 491 yards. It was the most by an opposing quarterback in Ohio Stadium since 1984. So the question that needs to be asked, does this concern you about whether Ohio State can actually play for a national championship?
That means, can they get through the Big Ten is what you're saying, not whether they can get to the playoff. I feel like those are two different questions.
It's going to be a one-game season for them to get to the to win the Big Ten and get to the playoff, and that's the mighty Northwestern Wildcats, whose defense is unbelievable. But I'm not asking you to forecast that. I'm saying if they get into a playoff with Alabama.
Here's the issue to me on that, Stu,
yeah,
is I don't think there's, as good as the receivers are on some of these Big Ten teams, and certainly they faced a couple at Indiana, and obviously I think Minnesota has 2 really good receivers, and certainly Purdue has 2 fantastic receivers. But the combination of having a good enough defense to give Justin Fields some problems, and also the firepower to attack Ohio State's defense. And remember, it's not just they lost a couple of big-time defensive backs. They lost Chase Young, who was really special up front, and they don't have somebody on that level right now. So I think it's a combination. Certainly Jeff Hafley was a terrific defensive coordinator for them. He's no longer there. He's now the head coach at BC, obviously. But, you know, I look at your alma mater, and I think they're much better on offense. Peyton Ramsey made some terrific throws yesterday, and they do, you know, they're a really good team. I just don't think the receivers are dynamic enough to exploit Ohio State the way you would need to. Because looking at that game yesterday, Indiana had some chances. I mean, they drop a fourth and two. Then they have their running back beats Tough Borland downfield and probably should have a 30-yard gain. It bounces off his hands. The next play, there's the Sean Wade pick six, which you'd think would have been a game ender, but credit to Indiana. They never give up, and they were in it right to the wire. But if you're going to play with that team in the Big Ten, because I do think once we get into the playoff, there are teams that are every bit as talented, maybe even more talented than them, whereas in the Big Ten, just your margin for error is so small. I just don't know. I mean, can Northwestern beat Ohio State? Sure. I mean, we saw Purdue and Iowa beat very talented Ohio State teams before. I mean, it's not like it can't happen, but I just think it's, I don't know. I just don't think they have enough to do that.
Yeah, I'm more projecting ahead. I mean, I think, first of all, for Northwestern fans, and I'm on this email list, somebody added me at some point to this email list of, like, quote-unquote VIP Northwestern alums who talk Ravel, about the games. And Ravel. The first two responses this morning were from Mike Greenberg and Seth Myers. People are fired up. I mean, at this point, it would be a surprise if they're not 8-0 going into the game, which is insane to say about a team that went 3-9 last year. But that defense is really good. Now, does that mean they can hang with Ohio State? I'm not ready to go there. I'm more thinking about if Ohio State gets into the playoff and plays faces those Alabama receivers, or faces those Clemson receivers, or Florida if they were to get in there. I think as of right now, you'd say, "Ooh, that's going to be a real problem for Ohio State secondary." But on the other hand, I'm like, "Well, wait a minute. I watched Alabama give up 670 something yards to Ole Miss a while back. I watched, Notre Dame, number two team in the country, great team." But I watched them give up the most passing yards in Notre Dame Stadium history to Clemson's backup quarterback. Florida, their defense is a train wreck. They're fortunate they have, possibly the Heisman-winning quarterback. So all of which is a way to say that, I think there may just not be a team with an elite defense. If there is, it might be Alabama, because they have not had anything close to a repeat of that Ole Miss performance since then. It could just be one of those weird things that happens early in the season. They lost to Ole Miss and went on to win the national title in 2015. To beat Kentucky, I know Kentucky doesn't have any offense, but to beat them 63-3 with Mac Jones not even playing a great game, like, I kind of think they're starting, in my opinion, it's starting to look less like, oh, here's the three best teams that are head and shoulders above everybody else, to Alabama might be a step above everybody else.
Yeah, I watched a lot of their game yesterday. I do think they look like they're tackling better now, especially in space. And their secondary looks like it's a lot more settled down than maybe it was early in the year. And I think with time, I think that's probably a big factor for that group. And so, as you said, I mean, this Kentucky team isn't what it was probably even at the beginning of the year, and some of the players they've lost, and certainly wasn't like what it was a year ago. But it was impressive what Alabama has done. I wanted to just finish one point on Northwestern, because I didn't know what the heck this was about. Pat Fitzgerald, who's very engaging, especially with the media, and can be a lot of fun to talk to, went off in the post game. So what exactly is the Reese Davis thing about?
Well, I didn't know myself. So Pat Fitzgerald is, most coaches, they do those post-game interviews, and they don't say all that much. He does this post-game interview with Molly McGrath, and he, is talking up a storm. And he says, as the team's rushing off the field, he points to them and goes, "How about the fighting Reese Davises, huh?" And I'm like, what is he talking about? And he made a quick reference to Joey Galloway, but I had no idea what he was talking about. Then I went on their post-game Zoom conference, and again, he's talking about the fighting Reese Davises and how insulting or disrespectful this comment was. And at that point, I'm texting their SID. What the heck did Reese Davis say? Well, it turns out it wasn't Reese Davis. It was Joey Galloway. They did a segment on that Tuesday night. I guess the Tuesday night show debuted last week, even though there was no actual committee rankings. They had Pat Fitzgerald on as a guest. And then after his, I'm sure that was taped, after that ended, they do like a roundtable. What do you think about Northwestern? And they go to Joey Galloway, and he says, I've watched Northwestern. Let me tell you, there are a bunch of Reese Davises running around out there, as in completely unathletic. So Fitzgerald, you know, like that guy has a huge chip on his shoulder. He has since he was a player. He's all about being the underdog. And boy, did he make a big deal out of that. His players made a big deal out of that. I mean, a couple of them came on the Zoom call and they were pissed off about it. So, you know, Joey Galloway ended up inadvertently providing some serious bulletin board material for a team that ended up basically just completely shutting down Wisconsin and winning 17-7.
Question for you. Would you have been offended if Joey Galloway had said, they got a bunch of Stu Mantels out there?
I wouldn't have. The Reese Davis, that comment, if I had seen it in real time, I would have just chuckled and moved on with my life. But, you know, these coaches who, by the way, most of whom say they don't read or hear anything said about them, they'll use anything, right? I mean, how many times have you heard a coach after a game mention that nobody picked them on game day? I think they know. They pay attention to this stuff, and they know that it resonates with the player. Like, let's say I write a column ripping some team. Like, Pat Fitzgerald's not going to get in front of his team and show, like, a printout of the article. This guy who you've never heard of called you blah, blah, blah. But they know Reese Davis. They know Joey Galloway. They watch TV. So, or Kirk Herbstreit or whoever. So, I think that works better. Look. I get it. Like they're always going to have this stereotype or this perception that they're a bunch of, you know, overachieving, you know, slow guys. Not this year's defense. I mean, they've got a couple guys, in particular, this defensive end who's come on as a sophomore, Eku Iota. He's a beast. Greg Newsom is a shutdown cornerback. This redshirt freshman safety. Joseph already has 5 interceptions. And then they've got those linebackers who've been, I mean, it feels like Patty Fisher has been at Northwestern since like, I don't know, since Damian Anderson was a running back there. Like he's been there forever. They're really good. Now, offensively, you know, Peyton Ramsey's a big upgrade from what they had last year, but they had nothing last year. They're still pretty underwhelming. And so that's why, like you said, if they were to play Ohio State, like they're not going to be able to bust big plays on that defense like Indiana did. But trust me, the Northwestern community, if they even just go into that Big Ten title game, they'll be thrilled.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
I think the weirdest thing, and we don't want to go down the road again of like we're not going to spend every week here talking about Penn State and Michigan and all these teams that are underperforming, but gosh, Nebraska getting creamed by Illinois was really jarring. Like, how can this team still be so bad well into Scott Frost's third season?
It's a good question. I mean, I read our colleague Mitch Sherman's column today, and Scott Frost didn't shy away from it, but at the same time, you know, it's you look at it, and Illinois ran the ball down their throats. I mean, they had two guys who had big days. They McCaffrey had a bunch of turnovers for Nebraska. I mean, they looked, you know, they looked as bad as I think they've looked at any point in Scott Frost's time there, considering the opponent, you know. And I know that one of the things that Frost talked about in Mitch's column was, yeah, you won a game last week. It's not like the mentality is so, you know, should be like, you're not good. You know, you haven't, you know, you won games, so what? And at the same time, you know, it's just, it's surprising. I mean, I don't really know how much more to say. I thought they would have been a lot further along than where they are. I mean, it's not like Scott Frost doesn't know what he's doing. It's not like he doesn't know what it takes to win there either. But it's just, it's puzzling. Again, I mean, I'm not saying that they should be a top 10 team right now. I would have thought they, by year three, I would have thought they'd have been closer to this. I mean, they're nowhere near it right now. And I think if you're a Nebraska fan, I mean, he definitely needs more time. It's only, you know, pretty much the beginning of year three. But you'd expect to see more. I mean, when you see some of these other programs who are in similar stages, I mean, we talked a bunch about Jeremy Pruitt in Tennessee, and that place, at least in terms of what their record looks like and performance on the field, it's not going in the right direction. It's going in the wrong direction. And with Nebraska, it just feels like, I don't know. I don't even know what more to say about it.
I mean, I think he himself, I mean, first of all the hype around him coming off the UCF season created some pretty lofty expectations that he was going to come in. I mean, remember how quickly he turned around UCF. So there was this feeling that he would do the same thing there. Also, I mean, he went out and Mackenzie Milton was a complete afterthought as a recruit. He goes in, he plugs him in, he plugs in some other guys, and they have this amazing offense. People thought he could do that in Nebraska. And then he raised the bar himself with some kind of cocky comments. I remember being at Big Ten Media Days before his first season, and he said something like, you know, people better take their shot at us this year because, you know, basically we're going to get really good really fast. So, you know, I don't know if it's this simple, but neither Adrian Martinez or Luke McCaffrey seem to be anywhere near where you think they would be in their development as quarterbacks. I know it's more than just the quarterback position.
I think, Stu, one thing that if you watch McCaffrey yesterday and seen some, this was an issue with Adrian Martinez last year, was guys who are trying to do too much. And that often leads to turnovers. And that's what it looked like from Luke McCaffrey yesterday. And, you know, again, it's, I don't know how you get guys settled down. And it's just, you can hear all these things about trust the process and, you know, don't try to just do your job. But at some point, it's just, you know, it's not resonating.
The best thing Scott Frost has going for him is that they will be patient. It's not a, like the Tennessee fans who are ready to run off Jeremy Pruitt or any number of other cases you see like that. They're going to be patient. We talk about how, you know, with Michigan and Harbaugh and, you know, if he can't make it, who can? But like Scott Frost, if you were to build the prototype of who should be a successful Nebraska coach based on his upbringing and his history there and then the experience he's had as a coach and, you know, very successful system under Chip Kelly, and then the success he had at UCF. Like, if this, you got to give this guy a chance, and I think they will. I think a lot of schools will look at this COVID year as a do-over, and certainly I think Nebraska will. So I'm not worried about his job security, and by any means. The question is, what's it gonna take? What's the magic lever he's gonna pull that gets them out of this? I just don't know. But I do think, like, as hard as Nebraska pushed to play this football season, I think probably at this point they wouldn't mind if it just went ahead and ended and they can fast forward to 2021, because there's no great answers with this team this year. Wanted to bring up Georgia. JT Daniels finally played. So JT Daniels has had a long road back. You know, he hurt his knee in the first game of the 2019 season. It was actually August 31st, as he pointed out, and he had not played a down of football since. And then He started against Mississippi State. We know that that program has been looking for its quarterback now for several years. And in his very first start, he throws for 401 yards, which of course leads to the question of why didn't they play him sooner? I was under the impression that he wasn't cleared or was still too hurt to play up until now. That's not the case. Kirby Smart kind of laid out the timeline. We read Seth Emerson's article about it. And basically, yeah, he wasn't cleared for the Arkansas game at the opener. And it sounds like his injury was really limiting him in preseason camp and even early on in practice in terms of his mobility. But it does sound like they could have pulled Stetson Bennett and Dwan Mathis for him at any time in the last several games. And they didn't. Not only did he not do it, but the call came after the Florida game, after they went through both those other quarterbacks without putting JT Daniels in. After that game, they said, okay, you're the number one QB now. I mean, if you're a Georgia fan, you look back now and go, maybe we would have had a better chance against Florida if you just played this guy then.
I mean, they were clear about, though. He did, you know, he did announce that he was medically cleared after the first week. I mean, I don't think that was a mystery. I just, from my understanding, it's JT Daniels has not, had really not done anything in practice that really wowed anybody. And so I think a lot of times coaches will look at this and look, this maybe will the same thing that we're seeing to some degree with Michigan and Cade McNamara, where what you see during the week is one thing, and then what happens in the game when the lights are bright is something different. And a lot of times coaches are going to go with a guy they feel the most confident in, and that's what they feel from Monday through Friday. So I think there's that. You know, and look, I mean, Stetson Bennett played well against Auburn, so it wasn't like there was no option or anything like that. I think it was after that. It was really from the Alabama game on, from the second half of the Alabama game, is when he really looked shaky. Now, we know he has a shoulder injury that he's been dealing with, but I think there was that. And I don't know. I'm not sure. You know, when I look at this, my takeaway is they played a Mississippi State team that is really bad, that only had 49 players or 49 scholarship players, and they barely survived that game at home, no less. I mean, to me, Georgia has been one of the bigger disappointments. You know, we can talk about all these Big Ten schools, but considering how most of us thought Georgia should be a playoff team or like looked at them as a top five team, you know, it's a head scratcher to see, you know, they lost by two touchdowns, obviously, at Alabama, or three touchdowns, I guess it was, or lost handily to Florida, gave up a ton of yards. I mean, this defense has been pretty disappointing, I think. And that was one of my takeaways yesterday. Was I could not believe how much they were struggling with that Mississippi State team.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, first of all, it's possible that we're reading too much into JT Daniels' performance against Mississippi State. But, you know, he's not a complete unknown. We've seen him have great moments as a freshman at USC. So I'm not so worried about that. But, yeah, at least last year when Jake Fromm was struggling and you wondered where their receivers were, at least the defense was playing at a high level. That clearly hasn't been the case this year. They got obliterated by both Kyle Trask and Mac Jones and even struggled a little bit against Mississippi State. So not sure what happened there. And you're right. I mean, at the end of the day, they're 5-2. It's not the worst thing in the world, but they certainly haven't been what we thought they would be. And if I think there would probably be more discussion of that, if not for the fact that you've got these much more high-profile and drastic flameouts with some big-name schools in the Big Ten. I mean, I found myself glued to the TV Saturday night to see if Michigan was going to be able to pull it out against Rutgers. Never in a million years would you guess you'd be in that situation right now. So I think all of that has overshadowed really disappointments, any number of disappointments elsewhere. In fact, I'll bring up one that's gotten no attention. Virginia Tech under Justin Fuente. That program, he got off to a good start there, and then they've kind of stagnated. And then even this year, they were ranked in the top 20 early on and really explosive on offense. And it's just gone in the complete wrong direction. They've lost three in a row. They got really embarrassed by Pitt on Saturday. So they're 4-5. Clemson is up next, so they're probably going to finish with a losing record in the regular season for the first time since 1992. Is Justin Fuente in any danger?
I mean, that's a lot of money they're going to have to pay if they're going to move on. I think it's over $12 million, and I don't know if Virginia Tech's going to throw that money around. Again, as you said, Justin Fuente got off to a really strong start in Blacksburg. Now, though, they've lost three in a row and four of their last five. And by the way, the teams they're losing to in the last, you know, month or so, they lost at Pitt to a team that was really depleted. They lost to Miami, which was also depleted and barely could play in the game. They lost to Liberty, which is a year removed from being an FCS program. And then they lost to Wake Forest. I mean, it's not... You know, you'd think they would be a lot better. I don't know if this is the year they would pull the plug on it. And again, a little bit like Scott Frost, Justin Fuente is a known commodity. He did a really terrific job turning around Memphis. Like, we know Memphis now to be a really good program. It wasn't when he took it over. But right now, Virginia Tech, he took a bunch of transfers, and a lot of those guys have been key contributors. But again, they are 4-5, and they're going to play a very pissed off Clemson team next. Good luck, you know.
Justin Fuente, his first two seasons, 10-4, played in the ACC title game, 9-4. Since then, 6-7, 8-5, now 4-5. And one thing I'd note about that 8-5 season last year is they lost to Virginia for the first time in, 15 years? So I would highly advise him to win that game this year. I don't know. I mean, we said with South, you know, would this be a year where there is no coaching carousel? South Carolina already proved that wrong. If you're going to, I mean, it would be expensive, but it might be worth making the move if you really think he's not the guy, because there's some good coaching candidates out there. And so there won't be as many schools vying for the Billy Napiers, the Hugh Freezes, and any number of other guys. But something worth watching. I mean, that's a program that's really been trying to rediscover itself since Frank Beamer. And I don't know. I don't necessarily think he's the guy to turn it around, but I would understand if they gave him a mulligan.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com, and we got some good ones. Let me start with... All right, Josh Boyd has two questions for us, Bruce. Feel free to answer. And they're both good questions. Let me start with the second one first because it's a little more clear cut. Could you see Mario Cristobal leaving Oregon if a job like Michigan or Texas opens up? Please say no.
I could see Mario Cristobal possibly leaving for a job if USC opened up. If I'm USC, I would look hard at Mario Cristobal and look, they're 3-0 right now. But obviously I feel like there's been a hot seat for 2+ years around Clay Helton. If that job were to open up, Mario Cristobal recruits his ass off, plays really, really physical football, and if Mario Cristobal is bringing Joe Moorhead and Andy Avalos, I think that would work at USC.
Don't you think at this point, Clay Helton's, I mean, barring a complete collapse, probably safe for another year? I mean, I know they're not looking, they don't look like a national title contender, which is what USC fans expect, but they're 3-0, and it's not like they're playing a murderer's row down the stretch.
No, they're not. Yeah. I mean, they would, I don't know what it would take for them to end up like 3-4 this year or something for the bottom to drop out. I mean, the schedule is, you know, they could probably lose two of these games, and they would be big upsets if they did, and I still don't think they would pull the plug. That's why I don't think this is a now situation. I would imagine if they were to make a coaching change, it would probably be at, you know, some point later in 2021, if it got to that point. And who knows, maybe they'll build off the momentum this year of a solid year. They've had a bunch of decent things happen around the athletic department off the field. But again, just to answer Josh's second question, I don't know if I necessarily see Mario Cristobal at Michigan or at Texas. I could see him more at USC than those other ones. It just feels like they would be more interested in him than those two other schools would.
He does have a good thing going there. It's not like, I don't think Oregon is a school you jump for just anybody, but okay, this second question is pretty intriguing, and again with USC tie. When looking at overall career, not just college, not just NFL, both, could the argument be made that Pete Carroll is a better coach than Nick Saban?
You could make that argument, because I would say hands down Nick Saban is the greatest college football coach of all time, but yet Pete Carroll won a Super Bowl and has done a remarkable job, not just what he did at USC, but certainly what he has done on an even bigger stage in the NFL. Jimmy Johnson's done that, what he did at Miami, and then certainly what he did with the Cowboys, and won more in the NFL than Pete did. But from that standpoint, yes, I think an argument could be made. I'm not, we're a college football podcast, so I kind of default to Saban on that. But I could see, Josh, there's definitely an argument to be made on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like you said, I mean, the list of coaches who have won a national championship and a Super Bowl, is it just Jimmy Johnson and Pete Carroll? I mean, that's impressive.
I mean, you've seen guys win national titles in college and be spectacular failures in the NFL. Lou Holtz was a disaster with the Jets. Steve Spurrier was a disaster with the Redskins. Now, Nick Saban, if he had had more time with the Dolphins, he might have been a team that could have made, or a franchise that could have made a run at the Super Bowl. Who knows? But like, because he wasn't a disaster, but he basically jumped at Alabama when the chance, and obviously that's paid off.
The only reason I'm hesitating to entertain that theory is that it's not like Nick Saban is just a successful college coach. He's overseen what I think is unquestionably the greatest dynasty in the history of the sport. So to say somebody's better as a football coach, Pete Carroll won two national titles in college. I don't want to understate that, but is that in a Super Bowl enough to compare with a guy who's won six college national titles? I'm not sure.
All right, Stu, this is from our friend Dan Klobuchar, who asks in Minneapolis, who always seems to ask some pretty sharp questions. Between the ending of the Arkansas-Auburn game, the botched kickoff in the Ole Miss-Auburn game, and now the awful offensive pass interference call at the end of the Purdue-Minnesota game, isn't it time to revamp the instant replay system? Right now, we have a procedure that allows 8 minutes to review a TD and overtime of a Clemson-Notre Dame game, but there's no way to overturn bad calls that potentially cost teams games. What do you think about
that? The whole college officiating system is broken, and has been for some time. I thought when they did move to the central, you remember the Miami-Duke 8 gazillion laterals play that shouldn't have counted? That was a moment that like actually caused some changes. That was the moment that caused, I think the SEC was, maybe the ACC was first and then the SEC. But eventually everybody adopted these centralized command centers back in the league office. And I thought, okay, that's what they need. That'll really help things. No, you still have these, strange replay situations every week. But it's bigger than that. I mean, college football officiating is kind of amateurish given the stakes, I mean, given, you know, these results, millions and millions of dollars trade hands based on wins and losses in these games. And you've got guys who, this is a part-time job for them, right? You've got guys who are insurance salesmen and whatever else. And then, you know, they get the weekends off in the fall to go officiate college games. I don't know if you can, I mean, that Purdue, you and I were texting about it, that phantom offensive pass interference that wiped out Purdue's winning touchdown was one of the more bizarre calls I've ever seen. But at the end of the day, it was a judgment call, and he's right. You can't, the replay official can't get on the thing and say, no, that wasn't offensive pass interference. They're there to, you know, strictly to correct, like, actual, like, errors of game management. They can't say, we disagree with that call. So should they be able to? Should they be able to say, you blew that one and we're going to overturn it?
I would think that would be probably a good thing, but that only muddles it up even further, right?
The reason that they don't do that is entirely about not wanting to hurt the officials' feelings, really. Like, they don't want the officials to feel like they've got Big Brother looking over them, you know, stepping, ready to step in at any moment and tell them they screwed up. So I don't know. I don't know what the ideal situation is. I do know that the current system where the ACC has their coordinator and the Big Ten has their coordinator and they do a couple seminars and but at the end of the day, like, the officiating is very inconsistent from one conference to the next, is broken. And I just, is there enough incentive, is there enough people in the sport disgruntled about it to actually change it, or are we just going to keep doing this year after year? I don't know.
This question from David in Delaware. Love the show. I know Penn State isn't going to fire James Franklin after one bad season, no matter how terrible it is. But has a coach ever had this bad of a season in the middle of his tenure and then gone on to accomplish anything significant?
Yes.
Yes, blue blood program. Okay, go ahead.
I have an answer. It's a fairly recent answer. And the answer is Brian Kelly.
Pat Fitzgerald?
Well, Pat Fitzgerald did go 3-9 last year, but
yeah, they were horrible.
I don't know that that's an equivalent situation, considering he'd already been there for 15 years at that point. Yeah, when Notre Dame went 4-8 in 2016, after being predicted in the preseason, I think, to be a top 10 team, you know, everybody thought that's it. Like, they're gonna have to fire Brian Kelly. I know there was talk of firing Jack Swarbrick because he was so adamant about keeping Brian Kelly. And what did he do? He looked at every aspect of the program. He overhauled the staff. He brought in some really great coordinators. And they've had the best run of his tenure since then. So now that's the exception. Normally, yeah, it is hard to get it back on track. But there is a recent example of that. The key is that, like I said, there was never any possibility Jack Swarbrick was going to fire Brian Kelly. He knew that he's got a good coach on his hands, who at that point had taken them to a national title game and had New Year's Six Bowl appearances, and he was going to give them a chance to turn it around. And that's absolutely what will happen here with Sandy Barber and James Franklin, and we'll see what happens. He definitely needs to make some big changes because they are terrible. And
this, yeah, you know, there's another example of this right in your backyard, actually.
David Shaw.
I mean, well, they are terrible right now.
Yeah, but we haven't seen the other side of that yet. He's going to have to do the same kind of thing.
No, I'm saying it's very applicable in terms of to the James Franklin question, though. I mean, he's in a similar situation.
And to bring up your Pat Fitzgerald example, I mean, that was a situation where that offense had been stagnating for years, and but he was very loyal to Mick McCall, the OC, and but it took a complete bottoming out for him to finally acknowledge he needed to make a change, and he did. And it's night and day. So the problem with Penn State is I don't know that there's just one single thing that can be pinpointed quite that easily. It's just the entire team seems to be affected, and it just really hasn't handled, you know, the defections and injuries they've had very well. So, but there is hope, David. There is hope. This one is from Benoit in Montreal, Quebec. Gentlemen, although this is going to be a less active coaching carousel than usual, given his recent success at SMU and now at Miami, is Rhett Lashley a legit candidate to become a Power 5 head coach?
I think he should be. I think he's a candidate, certainly at Utah State, which is obviously not a Power 5 job. I don't know if South Carolina will look at him that closely. I think he's definitely would be on their radar, but I know there's some other candidates they're seem to be very intrigued by. We'll see how many other jobs open up at this point, but I think he's done a really, really good job at Miami and certainly at SMU, and he's grown, and I think anybody who's ever spent any time around him goes, yeah, I could definitely see this guy as a college head coach, and pretty much almost anywhere now. I mean, it's not like he was just seen as, oh, this guy's just an SEC guy. I think he has shown that from his time in Texas, now from his time in South Florida, I think he's impressed a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, I think he was so tied to Gus Malzahn for so long there that it was hard to separate it, but now he's, you know, gone on and done his own things and has been very successful at it. I think probably he would get looked at for a Group of Five head coach job, more so than a Power Five, but who knows? And one more coaching carousel. Go ahead.
You know, if you're let's say you're Kansas or something, and that job were to come open, I mean, I would look at Rhett Lashley.
All right, here's one last coaching carousel one for you from Craig J. McMichael. It's an interesting one. With the coaching carousel starting to turn again, we hear a lot of names out there. One we never hear is Doc Holliday at Marshall. He seems to always have had a consistent and, dare I say, pretty, pretty good program. Is there a reason we haven't heard his name in coaching searches this year or in years past? Thanks, guys. Can't wait for the next season of Curb. Neither can we.
I think part of it, Stu, is because he's in his mid-60s right now. And usually those are not guys who get opportunities at, you know, to be a first-time Power 5 head coach. The only place I think that there was maybe some thought on him was he has a lot of ties, certainly in West Virginia. And when Dana Holgorsen was leaving, I think some people looked at it and go, well, that guy would love to be here. But obviously that the hire they made was Neil Brown, and that's looking like a really terrific hire. But that's about the only place I think I've heard from a Power Five stance that would look at him. But no doubt he's done a really good job. But I think his age and at this stage of his career is probably something that some other schools will, you know, fair or unfair, would hold against him.
Doc Holliday, not only does he never get mentioned for the coaching carousel, I don't think either of us have ever put him in our top 25 coaches. He's been the Marshall's head coach since 2010. It's been a little up and down, but in there is a 10-win season, a 13-1 season in 2014. The last few years, 8-5, 9-4, 8-5, 7-0 to start this season. Marshall is one of those programs that got really, they were one of the losers in conference realignment. Because when you think back to when Randy Moss was there and Chad Pennington was there, like, Marshall was a very respected.
That is a long
That was a long time ago, too. Mid-major program. But when the wheels spun and they ended up in, like, they're in Conference USA, but Tulsa's in the American. Like, based on history, that doesn't make any sense, but that's just the way it played out. Nobody's really, you know, racing to have a school in Huntington, West Virginia in their conference. So you just, I think Conference USA in general, just they're barely on TV. You never see those teams play. And so he's kind of just fallen under the radar. But if they keep this up, if they run the table, they're not going to make a New Year's Six Bowl, I don't think. But, you know, hopefully they put them somewhere in a spot where they can play somebody good and get a little bit of a showcase.
All right. As always, you can send your questions to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We will see you next time.